This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October the 26, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. Any use of this without the permission of your State Society or Nichols Patrick is prohibited. It's copyright by Nichols Patrick 2015. We're going to talk this week about some of the things that came out regarding federal taxes in the current week. And some of the biggest things we had this week related to issues of getting inflation-adjusted numbers for the year. It's October, so it's that time of year again when we start getting all of our inflation-adjusted numbers for the following year. And actually, as we're going to discover here, because inflation was not running at a terribly fast clip, a lot of numbers are either not changing or changing very minorly in the inflation-adjusted arena for following years. But we're going to start out with an update the IRS gave this week to the Security Summit report. Back in June, we discussed that the IRS had a Security Summit report that dealt with members of industry and the IRS, people involved in tax preparation, dealing with some of the problems we have with tax return refund fraud. This report was issued. It's a working group that consists of members of the software industry, members of the preparer community, and consists of the IRS, trying to work to get a handle on the problem that we've all seen that's become far more significant, of refund fraud, where people file returns on behalf of taxpayers, claiming fraudulent refunds disappear, and then we're all stuck with cleaning up the mess, and the clients are stuck with a major mess as they try to deal with the fact that the service now has multiple returns, all of which claim to come from them, and we're going to have to work this out. Those frauds impact both the federal and the state level. This Security Summit group was put together to try to deal with this by the IRS, the state revenue departments, at least most of them, and various members of industry. They issued their report back in June talking about what they're going to be doing. On October 20th, they gave a status update of what the group's been doing and specifically some of the steps they plan to take for next year. In that update, which is basically IRS News Release 2015-117, and a fact sheet 2015-23, we get some updates on the work of the group. Now, the first thing which they said, there's going to be some changes in authentication for next year. These are going to be involved with data elements in transmissions to help the IRS identify fraud. So as returns are transmitted, they're going to start looking for things. There's going to be 20 new data elements from the transmissions that will be shared with the IRS and the states, and that will assist in detecting and preventing these identity theft returns. Some of the things they're going to be doing is they're going to review the transmission of the return, including maybe the improper or repetitive use of Internet protocol numbers, otherwise known as IP addresses. The issue being there, many of these frauds are frauds where they file a whole bunch of returns from one location at the same time. So, for instance, even though they might use an online tax service, and there was some use of that, especially at the state frauds last year that was of that sort, it would be highly unusual, shall we say, for 200 returns to come within a minute from the same IP address into a system like, you know, a TurboTax or any other sort of filing system. Also, it would be highly unusual for the IRS to receive directly, you know, hundreds of thousands of returns from an IP address that doesn't appear to be coming from an IP address that they normally would see, or somebody like, let's say, CCH or Lacerte, who's receiving returns to transmit on behalf of their customers, seeing tons come from an address that doesn't make sense. So we're going to start seeing some analyzing of the IP address from which a return comes and looking for unusual activity on that address. That would be one of the things that apparently we're going to be doing it. We're going to look at a computer identification, device identification tied to the origin of the return. This is especially for the online tax services, but also may impact us when we look at transmitting returns through services like Intuit or CCH. This may end up with where we end up with, they will put in, just like many cases your banks do now, when you first log in to transmit, they'll give an ID for return. And if a new return attempt, if a new computer attempts to be used to transmit a return, they're going to potentially force you to go through more verification steps. The idea is, you know, if normally your returns are transmitted from, you know, a few machines that are in your office, and suddenly out of the blue, a machine that has never been used on your account starts transmitting returns, there may be a challenge to that. So start looking at things like that. They're going to review the time it takes to complete a tax return. They're going to be taking a look. If you've got a one person authorized to file returns, can they really do 4,000 returns in an hour? Probably not. So they're going to be taking a look at that. You know, how quickly, how fast are they submitting? Even if you are holding returns in your office to finalize stuff, it's unlikely that 4,000 of them will suddenly disappear or drop in at one time. And they'll also capture additional metadata. Metadata is stuff that comes along with a transmission that involves this. And what they're going to look at is other details that come along with the transmission that may be transmitted as part of the internet, as part of the whole standard routine of what we do for the internet, or parts of the TCP/IP protocol. They're going to be looking at more detail of that, trying to identify fraudulent transmitters, in essence, things that look unusual. So they're talking about having worked on that. They also noted that they reached some agreement for tax software providers. And it's not clear from their note whether this is going to flow down to those of us who are submitting through software providers, you know, something like where we transmit our returns up to somebody like Intuit or CCH, who then transmits them on, or Thomson Reuters, who transmits them on to the IRS. But it seems likely we may see it come down to that level. And what they're going to start doing is they're going to have new password, minimum password standards. Complex passwords will be a minimum of 8 characters, uppercase, lowercase, alpha, numerical, and special characters. Now, little aside commentary here, that's all well and good, and actually very important that we have things that are not dictionary words, so it will eliminate that. What unfortunately it won't eliminate is if you're reusing the same password to transmit returns up to your software provider that you're using for other purposes on the internet. If you're doing that, you are definitely at risk to having your account compromised and used for fraud. The reason being, quite often, people who are trying to do this sort of thing will go try to find a site, like let's say you signed up for your high school reunion website and to, you know, make comments and stuff, they required you to register. And you got an email, so you put in your email address and you put together a password. If you put a password in there, the odds are they're not guarding that site terribly carefully to make sure that hackers can't get in and grab information. They probably also are storing the passwords in the clear, both of which are bad things. If that same password is used on your account that you use to file with your tax return, your software provider, well, all they'll need to do is find a way to link up your name to the firm, which is probably pretty easy. Get the firm's address. I know it for the software provider I use. By default, my account number goes on every return, so it's not that difficult to discover that if you look at all. And then they could go ahead and be able to log in and now submit returns up via that mechanism. So be very careful about passwords. They're going to have a timed lockout feature, which, and my software already has that. If you go too far, you know, after you've logged in, after a certain period of time, it simply logs you out. And they're also going to have a limit on the unsuccessful login attempts. So if somebody logs in unsuccessfully multiple times, you'll be locked out of the account. The software I use, also CCH, currently does that if you try it. And obviously, that's always frustrating because, you know, you do that accidentally and then you got to go through the whole process of getting redone. But that's to keep people from being able to guess. If you recall the celebrity photos that got loose from the Apple servers, that was because at the time Apple didn't limit the number of guesses you had to guess a password, and they obviously guessed the password. We're going to put in 3 security questions. Be very careful here. I understand the reason for it, but the problem is all too often the security questions are things people could find out otherwise. Seriously consider using a password manager and creating a totally fake answer and then storing the fake answer so you can provide it, but giving real ones is always kind of a problem. And there's going to be out-of-band verification for email addresses. They'll send an email or text to the customer with a PIN. That is to try to prove when you log in. For instance, I know your email address, I know, and I got your password. Well, I still probably may not have control of your email address, unless, of course, you use that to log in for your email server, in which case then this is not going to work. But the idea is, when you try to sign up with a service, it would send back a PIN to that email address so you can prove you have control of the email account. That will reduce, not eliminate, none of these solve problems. They all may reduce them to some extent, although I'll be honest, I think the security questions in some cases actually opens up a hole. But nevertheless, That's what we're going to be doing. So don't be surprised if you see some changes in your software this year. Next up, Revenue Procedure 2015-53. In this case, the IRS gives us all of the inflation-adjusted numbers, and that's, you know, so look for Revenue Proc 2015-53. It's got the new tax rates for 2016. These are all the 2016 numbers that we have. Those are rates for individuals, estates, and trust. By the way, don't forget for estates and trust, under the net investment income tax, they begin to pay for AGIs in excess of where that top rate begins, and that top rate will now begin at $12,400. So you can be on there. Because of the low level of inflation last year, many of the numbers remain the same or have only very, very slight increases. We're not looking at anything that changed dramatically in these numbers. Now, the details go on for quite a while, but I'll give you some of the basics here, some of the things you might be interested in. The exemption amount for the AMT is always of interest, and if you're planning for that for 2016, on a joint return, that's going to go to $83,800, single and head of household to $53,900, a married couple filing a separate return will go to $41,900, and estates and trust go to $23,900. The standard deduction will rise to $12,600 for a married couple filing a joint return, $9,300 for head of household, $6,300 for a single person, and $6,300 for a married person filing a separate return. The foreign earned income exclusion will go to $101,300. Now, one that gets changed normally simply because the number is so big, it's very easy for it to reach its trigger amount, is what we call the unified credit, what we used to call unified credit now, which is officially called the basic exclusion amount. The basic exclusion amount for 2016 will be $5,450,000, raising up from this year's $5,430,000. So slight increase, but not huge. However, the present interest gift amount will remain at $14,000. The gifts to a spouse who is not a U.S. citizen will be $148,000. Now, a whole bunch of penalties also got updated, and if you want to go there, remember, last year, Congress has now changed the law, so all of those dollar-denominated penalties are now subject to inflation adjustment. Therefore, rather than just remembering what the penalty is for 1099s, etc., we're going to have to go look up the new inflation-adjusted number every year. So be aware those numbers are also contained in this particular ruling. Another inflation-adjusted issue that came out that's not in that ruling but is in a separate IRS news release is an IRS news release 2014-99. This is where the IRS issued the numbers related for qualified plans and IRAs for 2016. And generally, this one really does. Nothing changes. Well, there's very little. We'll talk about what does change. But effectively, all the major numbers remain the same. So the maximum amount of compensation to be considered for a qualified plan is going to remain at $263,500. The 415 contribution limit for a defined contribution plan will be $53,000 with a maximum catch-up of $6,000. Elective deferrals, such as for 401ks, will remain max at $18,000. Highly compensated employees under 414Q remains at $120,000, and key employee number stays at $170,000. Simple deferrals will remain at $12,500. The simple catch-up remains at $3,000. The limit for SEP contribution will remain at $600. The maximum annual defined benefit that somebody could earn is going to stay at $210. The only thing really that changes is the phase out for where somebody can make a Roth IRA contribution, and for individuals who are filing joint, who are not covered by a plan but whose spouse is covered by a plan, and want to make a deductible contribution. For those individuals, the phase out for a married filing joint will begin at $184,000. Okay. Now for the Roth IRA, obviously, if you're not married, it's not going to be a problem for you otherwise. And by the way, if you're married, you're filing separate, the phase out is $10,000. But if you're single, the phase out for the Roth will now start at $117,000. These numbers only went up by $1,000 from their numbers for the year before where the phase out starts. And again, both Roth phase outs go over $10,000 range. So if we go $10,000 above that number, the amount of Roth contribution you can make phases out to zero. So those are both issues that we run into. Let's go on to a couple of court cases here. And the first one here is Poppy versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-205. Now, this is an interesting issue. This deals with actually an election under Section 475F. And for those who haven't memorized the code, that election deal is what could be made by somebody who is a trader in securities. Now remember, we have three types of people who deal with securities. We have a dealer who sells securities from their inventory. We have an investor, which is what most of our clients will be, who invest in the funds for, you know, more than mere short-term price swings. And we have a trader, somebody who's in the trader business of playing with securities, moving securities, playing on very, very, very short changes, very short-term changes in price, and usually have huge numbers of trades. This particular taxpayer, unlike a lot of the cases we see, he did have a whole bunch of trades. There's no question he did a whole bunch of trading. Well, he did it in the past, and it was part of a partnership that was doing it now. And the partnership kind of complicates the matter. We're not going to talk about that part of the deal because the tax court basically took care of him on this issue. He claims, now he filed returns late too, which didn't help matters. He claims that back on his 2003 return, he made a 475F election. We're looking at 2007 as the tax year here. Now, 475F election says we're going to treat these trading securities under what's called the mark-to-market method. By that, at the end of the year, any securities that he holds at the end of the year have to be, you know, if he holds any securities in his trading accounts on the last day of the year, we treat those as if they were sold right at the end of the year for their fair value. If you make that election, though, those gains or losses will be treated as ordinary. Now, gains treated as ordinary, well, that's, you know, kind of like, well, I don't really want that. I don't really care normally. Well, remember, these are very short term, so really doesn't matter probably for most things, except capital losses would offset against them. However, if you have net losses, you're not going to be subject to a $3,000 capital loss limitation. That's a big thing if you lose a lot of money. Mr. Poppy in 2007 lost a lot of money on his trading activities. He wanted to be able to claim an ordinary loss, and since if you're a trader business, if you claim this loss, you also can generate a net operating loss that will go back and you can get a refund of prior taxes. The problem which he had was, and which the court pointed out, was he could not show that he had made a proper election. The election is made under Revenue Procedure 99-17's terms. Now, one real quirk about this election is for the first year you want it to apply, the election must be made by the due date without extensions of your return for the year prior to the year you want the election to first apply. So if you want it to apply for 2015, you have to have made the election by, for an individual, April 15th of 2015, which was the due date of your 14 return without extension. Also, because this is a change of accounting method, you have to, when you file the 15 return, you'd have to file a Form 3115 asking for a change in accounting method. Generally, that's going to be required. So two parts. You have to show that you have to have an election that goes to the IRS by April 15th of the year in which you want the change to take place, and you have to attach a 3115 to the return and send a copy to the national office. The IRS said they had no copy of either item. Now, the IRS admitted at trial that they don't always record the 3115s. We kind of all suspected that those copies you send to national office or those copies on the returns many times don't ever get recorded. But in this case, the taxpayer had no copy of his or her own. And the court held that the burden is on the taxpayer, despite the fact this was a 2003 election, despite the fact that we're talking about a 2007 return, the taxpayer claims he made the election in 2003. The reality was 7 was the year when it mattered, and the taxpayer had the burden of proving an election had been made. Even though the IRS admitted that had he made an election, had they actually filed a 3115, they might have lost it. It doesn't matter. You have to prove you made the election. The taxpayer had the burden to prove an election was filed, even though the IRS admitted they might have lost at least the 3115. This is important because outside of just the 475 issue for a trader, this means any election that carries over, like an election, let's say, for a 754 election for a partnership, it's incredibly important to maintain in the permanent file for the taxpayer to maintain the permanent records. a copy of the election and a copy of the certified mail receipt showing that you mailed that particular copy to the service. So that you can go, so if this issue, the service raises this question and says, you know what, we don't think you had an election, you might be, you're going to have an issue. Next up is the case of the West case. This case is kind of interesting. This is a taxpayer asking for relief from late filing penalties. The mother of the executors had passed away, and after mom passed away, one of the kids emailed the attorney and asked the attorney, what all is going to be going on? How long does it have to take to finish and close up, mother's estate? And the email said basically asking what legal follow-ups are needed in the short term. The attorney for the decedent replied the next day, and he advised they need to pay all their final bills, possibly file a federal estate tax return and an individual return, and basically and a trust income tax return. He went on to explain that this all takes as short as a few months, or if an estate tax return is required, as long as 2 years. The following day, the son wrote back to the attorney and basically said he was sure there'll be tax due on the estate, and he assumed that the John Renner, who was the accountant for his mother, would take care of the estate tax. Okay, a couple of bad things happen here. The son apparently believed the attorney had just told him the estate tax return was due in 2 years. Secondly, the attorney has an email stating that he's not responsible for the estate tax return. This is going to go very badly here shortly. Because as he told the attorney, the accountant take care of the estate tax. They talked with the attorney once before the due date of the return, but they didn't actually raise the question of whether the return would be done, nor did they actually tell the attorney that he was going to be doing the estate tax return. After the date the estate tax return was due, they contacted the attorney, and at this point, effectively, gave him the idea that, oh, well, he's going to be filing the estate tax return. Now, remember, he'd been told that the accountant would take care of that. So he picks it up. We're past the due date for the return, but we're well within the six-month extended period, assuming the extension had been filed. And since he'd been told the accountant would take care of the 706, he assumed an extension had been filed. Turns out that was a bad assumption. Now, when they filed the return, he filed the return assuming an extension was there. The estate got billed for over $300,000 of late filing penalties. The taxpayer claimed, we have reasonable cause because, look, based on the advice of the attorney, we believe the return wasn't due for 2 years, and, we should be able to rely on that. The court said no. The district court said, sorry, guys. That what you asked the attorney could not even in the broadest sense be read as advice on the due date. A reasonable person who received that email, which talked just in generalities, would have clarified, asked for clarification. They're really going to rely on it for when to file the estate tax return of saying, well, okay, it's 2 years from what, as the court pointed out, was an interesting question in the thing. It said as long as 2 years. They're saying, and you met with the attorney, a little bit later. You should have specifically raised the issue if you were really trying to rely on somebody to know what date to file the return. You didn't. They also pointed out that you told the attorney that the accountant was going to file it. Apparently that didn't happen. So the court said, we're not going to worry about who's at fault for this being late filed at this point. We're simply going to say that the executors did not act reasonably to find their filing date. Therefore, they do not qualify for relief from the late filing penalty. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October the 26th, 2015. Be sure to tune in and listen to us next week for our updates for the following week. Also, you can visit us at our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. There we'll post updates during the week as things happen and post links to various documents that we're discussing in these sessions. Again, be sure to join us next week as we again try to figure out what happens in the area of federal tax.